Welcome. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to welcome and thank you for joining us for this activity entitled Early Detection, Better Direction, Tau Biomarkers and Amyloid Targeting Therapies in Alzheimer's Disease. This activity is supported by an unrestricted educational grant from Lilly, so we appreciate that. However, this is just Professor Zetterberg and I discussing this, and it's our content. I'll introduce myself. I'm Ali Razayatri. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for Banner Research. I also direct the Banner Sun Health Research Institute in Sun City, Arizona. I'm a cognitive neurologist, and I'm involved in clinical trials, and I take care of patients and families within the AD spectrum. And Professor Zetterberg is a world-renowned expert, really in the forefront of biomarkers. So, Henrik, I'll let you introduce yourself.
Yes, I work in Gothenburg at Sahlgrenska University Hospital, University of Gothenburg, with biomarker research and also clinical biomarker analysis. So I work in a clinical neurochemistry laboratory, analyzing CSF and blood samples from patients in memory clinics and also outside memory clinics, also in neurology departments in many different settings. And then I run the biomarker factory in London at the UK Dementia Research Institute, which is a laboratory where we try to scale up the new blood biomarkers to allow for more high throughput studies, for example, in molecular epidemiological settings. And then since recently, I also have an appointment as a visiting professor at University of Wisconsin, Madison. So that has also given me even more insight into the research that is happening in the US, and also some of the new clinical developments, since you have access to some of the anti-amyloid treatments, which are not yet approved in Europe.
Wonderful. We have our learning objectives. One is to identify the neuropathological changes that are associated with Alzheimer's disease, including those that are occurring downstream of amyloid accumulation, and particularly their relevance to cognitive and functional and basically clinical symptoms in early Alzheimer's disease. We also have a learning objective to assess the role of phosphorylated tau biomarkers as early indicators of both amyloid and tau accumulation. I'd love to hear about that from you, Henrik. Also an objective to evaluate the latest data from these clinical trials for amyloid-lowering therapies and what maybe are the kernels and pearls for practical clinical applications, and also identifying the appropriate patients, both pathologically and clinically, what are the characteristics to ensure that we actually have a timely, optimal management and choices for patients and families with early symptomatic AD. All right, so without further ado, we want to jump into it. And so this is an extremely exciting time for our field. I call it the end of the beginning, because we finally have, informed by biomarkers, we have drugs that are lowering the key component of Alzheimer's disease pathobiology. Henrik, can you do a little overview of how you think about these core pathologies in both diagnosis, in sort of the criteria, staging, and progression, including amyloid and downstream markers? What is the conceptual evidence now, and ultimately, how do you think it's going to be being translated to patients?
Yeah, it all goes back already to the days of Alois Alzheimer, who saw his first patient and examined her carefully. And then when she died, he examined her brain and described plaques and tangles and neuron loss. But of course, he had no clue about what these were composed of. And it was also uncertain if this was relevant to more old age memory problems. All those things were completely uncertain. And when Alzheimer's disease first was described in a textbook in 1911 by Emil Kraepelin, then it was described as a rare dementing disease characterized by this plaque, tangle, and neuron loss pathology, mainly affecting young people. So it was not until the 60s when British neuropathologists made huge efforts to examine people, older people who had died with dementia, and then they discovered that they actually looked much like the original case of Alzheimer's disease in their brain when examined neuropathologically. And then they counted plaque pathology, tangle pathology, and neuronal loss, and found correlations with degree of dementia beforehand, but cause and effect relationships were completely unknown. And then we have the seminal findings in 1984 and 1985 that plaques are composed of a small peptide called beta-amyloid. The 1985 paper, I think, is very important, because then in that paper you can really read about the molecular species of beta amyloid forming the plaque pathology. N-terminal truncated ending at 42, amino acid 42, which is very, that part of beta amyloid is very hydrophobic. And then tau was discovered a few years later, and the APP gene was found, the amyloid precursor protein gene, and then the mutations were found in 1991. The first mutation was discovered. In the meantime, also some biochemistry was done showing that if you add fibrillized beta amyloid onto neuronal cultures, then you get cytotoxic effects. And then all this developed into the amyloid cascade hypothesis, putting amyloid as a trigger of the disease. And I think that is where we are now. The biomarkers showed one really important thing, I think. There was a long-standing discussion on people who had died without dementia for other causes and who were examined at autopsy, also with neuropathology. And then they were some were shown to have relatively clear Alzheimer's pathology, with amyloid plaques and tangles and neuronal loss. But still, they hadn't been reported being cognitively impaired before death. And that was, of course, mentioned as a criticism against the amyloid cascade hypothesis. But when we got biomarkers to measure these pathologies, to me, that criticism was resolved to a large extent, because now we know that if you have amyloid and tangle pathology, according to the biomarkers, if you live long enough, you are very likely to get dementia. For example, if you are 70 years old and you are positive in regards to amyloid biomarkers by PET or cerebrospinal fluid, then the positive predictive value for getting Alzheimer's-like dementia, if you follow the patient for 10 years, is 96%. So most likely these autopsy studies were showing preclinical Alzheimer's pathology. So now we know that Alzheimer's starts in the brain tissue 15, 20, or even more years before onset of more clinically recognizable dementia. And there I think we have learned a lot from the biomarkers.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point about this association between the pathobiology, the disease itself having semi-silent phases that are very long and marching along, impacting, you know, amyloid, triggering neuroinflammation, sort of spreading the fire of the tangles through the brain, affecting the vasculature, probably affecting other organelles in the cells, mitochondria, protein degradation, etc. But somehow there is some reserve period. And then there is the clinical syndrome, the clinical stages, which are dissociated and can go from potentially being cognitively unimpaired to maybe having subjective cognitive changes, etc., to having this mild kind of impairment stages where we're just breaking down this continuum into little chunks where individuals may have objectively have symptoms, maybe even score lower, but be able to compensate for their daily life. And then ultimately the dementia stages. And this is an interesting conceptualization that's changed over the last decade, and there's more evidence for. So I'm interested to hear about the biomarkers. You mentioned, how do we measure these things now between neuroimaging and fluid biomarkers?
Yeah, so my specialty is the fluid biomarkers. But I would also like to mention, of course, the PET examinations that you can do now. There are, since many years now, really good tracers. They look a little bit like cyclophosphamide T in regards that they bind to beta pleated sheets very strongly to misfolded and aggregate the beta amyloid. And then they can be labeled with radioactivity, injected intravenously across the blood-brain barrier and bind to the amyloid plaques. This has now become a reference test for Alzheimer's disease. And they are now FDA approved and approved in Europe as well. And against the amyloid PET results, we have been able to validate cerebrospinal fluid tests. So now we know that the ratio of 42 to 40 amino acid long beta amyloid in lumbar CSF is very much concordant with amyloid PET positivity. The fluid biomarkers don't give any anatomic information, but in the symptomatic stage, that doesn't matter because then actually amyloid is relatively widespread. So we are more interested in the question if a patient has or does not have amyloid pathology. from a diagnostic standpoint. When we want to remove the amyloid with a treatment, then it has been really important that we have had access to the amyloid PET measures, because then I can have really been able to prove that these treatments actually reduce the brain pathology. And in that regard, this ratio in CSF is more difficult to interpret. One could also now regard the CSF A-beta 42 to 40 ratio almost as a reference test. So we have these two really well-validated biomarkers. In CSF, we can also measure tau proteins. Both a protein that we often refer to as total tau. It's a bit of a misleading concept, because we are not sure that test measures all forms of tau, but it's a marker that increases when neurons are affected by amyloid. It also increases in response to acute brain injuries following a stroke or brain trauma. So it's not completely specific to Alzheimer's disease. But then we have access to phosphorylated tau, and there are many phospho-tau forms. The phosphorylation of tau is a normal physiological mechanism through which it's almost like a plasticity marker. So when neurons are pruning synapses and retracting axons physiologically, tau is phosphorylated so that it lets go of the microtubule in the axons. Tau's normal function is to stabilize these neuronal extensions, the axons. But if a synapse is to be removed, tau phosphorylation happens. So phospho-tau levels are super high, for example, in newborn people, because then in newborns, a lot of pruning is happening. But then phospho-tau levels are reduced and stable throughout life. But if amyloid plaque starts to form, the amyloid pathology will affect surrounding synapses and give this type of pruning-like signal that involves tau phosphorylation. So amyloid induces tau phosphorylation and secretion from the neuron. These neurons that secrete tau, they are still alive. This phosphorylation happens inside living neurons. And when tau is phosphorylated, it becomes free-floating inside the neuron. And by relatively unknown mechanisms, it undergoes a cleavage, and the N-terminal part is secreted with phosphorylated amino acids on it. And that's the phospho-tau marker that we measure in CSF, and now also in blood. Part of tau that forms the tangles stays inside the neuron. And most often, in normal conditions, it likely undergoes lysosomal degradation and is cleared that way. And I think that's what's happening in kids, for example. Mm-hmm. But if you have an aged neuron, and if perhaps the amyloid plaques are inducing a lot of tau phosphorylation, the lysosomal system can be overflown or overridden, mm-hmm. and then you get free a microtubule binding domain containing tau, and this can aggregate into tangles. So the way we regard the fluid biomarkers for tau pathology now is that they are direct markers of an amyloid effect on neurons and predictive markers of formation of tangle pathology. But it's not like tangles are leaking the phospho-tau forms. We actually believe that for many years, including me. And we write that in some review papers, that this is a tangle pathology marker, the phospho-tau increase. But it's instead a marker of a process that increases the risk of tangles to form. And in regards to real fluid-based biomarkers for the tangle pathology, at the moment, we don't have well-established touch markers. But phospho-tau works really well to detect the pathophysiological pathway that brings you Alzheimer tangle pathology.
Henrik, you mentioned the N-terminus that's phosphorylated being secreted.
Yep.
And there's been a hypothesis that this is almost like it then induces a prion-like spread.
Exactly.
And that's how you can make sense of the Brock stages. Can you expand on that? Because that's very interesting and kind of goes along with tangle pathology being more proximal to symptoms and neurodegeneration.
No, that's such an exciting, we've learned a lot about this recently also. The phospho-tau that we are measuring, the secreted tau, that is not a substrate for the prion-like behavior of tau. That type of the N-terminal phosphorylated tau is very water soluble. It will not induce tangle pathology. But the C-terminal part that builds up inside neurons, and this, I really think the data are now beyond doubt that this can happen. In vesicles that are secreted, it can transmit to another neuron with misfolded MTBR C-terminal tau fragment containing forms that are misfolded. that seems to be able to induce a templated misfolding in neurons that are not affected directly by tau pathology as a start. So thereby, it seems like when tau pathology starts inside neurons with a misfolding, then that can spread from neuron to neuron. Potentially transsynaptically, it could also go through the dendrites. It's a little bit uncertain exactly if it requires being contained in a vesicle or if it can also happen by misfolded MTBR and citrullinated fragment containing tau just being transmitted through a fluid without being packaged in a vesicle. But it's very exciting and could potentially explain a little bit why it is important to start with anti-amyloid treatments early before tau pathology has taken off. And sometimes beta amyloid is described as a trigger of Alzheimer's disease, but then it is possible that one could get amyloid-independent tau pathology propagating over the brain tissue, at least if the process has been allowed to take off. And of course, one would like them to start with the treatment before that happens.
Right, right. You've now mentioned a fair bit of different types of tau and measures. The amyloid measures, you know, the ATN framework, the new conceptualization currently being revised is that we have some core biomarkers of A and also of T, and then there's neurodegeneration, and then, of course, there are some biomarkers being proposed for vascular dysfunction and inflammation and synucleinopathy, which can go along with AD pathology, co-pathology. But can you expand upon the different types of ways we can actually measure the A and the T a bit more? And then the other kinds of plasma markers versus CSF, are they measuring the same things? Are they measuring things that are delayed? And what kind of phospho-tau?
Exactly. Now, these are really, really important questions. I would like to start to mention also so that I don't forget it. The phospho-tau forms and the beta amyloid ratio can also be measured in plasma. And those, they started to become apparent 2017, 18, something like that, when both mass spec-based methods to measure a beta 42/40 ratio in plasma were published. And then a Japanese group actually took one of the highly sensitive total tau assays and made it phospho-tau specific and got a signal in blood. And since then, several research groups have developed plasma phospho-tau assays that now look really good. If we think about the A criterion in the ATN framework, amyloid PET and CSF A-beta 42/40 are really the gold standard biomarkers for the A criterion. In plasma, we have the A-beta 42/40 ratio. But that ratio is a bit problematic because in CSF, when you have amyloid plaques growing in the brain, you get a selective depletion of the fluid of the 42 amino acid long aggregation prone form of beta amyloid. So the ratio decreases around 50%. So it's a big decrease. In plasma, this amyloid pathology induced reduction in the ratio happens on top of beta amyloid from peripheral tissues, not affected by amyloid pathology in the brain. So blood platelets, myocytes, hepatocytes make beta amyloid and release beta amyloid. So then the reduction of the plasma beta 42/40 ratio by amyloid pathology in the brain becomes 10-12%. It's very small. And working in a clinical lab, it's like doing these measurements day by day or week by week in a stable manner with assays that are precise enough to detect this small change is a challenge. It's not an easy thing to do. You need to keep very tight control on the biomarkers. So for the A criterion, most studies suggest that the most robust biomarker in blood for amyloid pathology is plasma phospho-tau, which sounds confusing. But the way I described it with that plasma phospho-tau senses an amyloid effect on the neurons, making them phosphorylate and secrete tau, that to me makes sense. And then when you have amyloid plaques growing in the brain, the plasma phospho-tau concentration increase is 2, 3, 4, 5-fold, even 6-fold, depending on how intense the process is and how many neurons are affected, basically. So it's a much clearer biomarker change than that 10 12-14% reduction of the plasma Aβ42/40 ratio.
The characteristics for the signal to noise is much more clear.
Exactly.
So which makes it much more desirable as an amyloid marker, even though, like you mentioned, it's phosphatau.
Exactly. And in clinical chemistry, we talk about robustness. It's a very vague but also extremely practical concept. How if the pathology-induced change in the biomarker is really big, then confounders like comorbidities, kidney-induced function, and so that affect many plasma biomarkers, plasma clinical chemistry tests. If the fold change induced by the pathology exceeds the effect of confounders, then a biomarker is typically regarded as robust. That could also have to do with pre-analytic variation. If you take the sample in the morning or the afternoon, fasting or non-fasting. So if we now know from epidemiological studies that, for example, people with kidney dysfunction might have 10% higher plasma phosphatau, but that doesn't destroy the biomarker because you can still detect a 2-3-fold increase by the pathology. So that's a typical, from my standpoint, looking across clinical chemistry tests, phosphatau seems to be a really robust biomarker for Alzheimer's disease. That pretty much summarizes the A part. So A would be CSF, Aβ42/40 ratio, amyloid PET, and plasma phosphatau. Even though we shouldn't forget the plasma Aβ42/40 ratio, because if it's a specialized lab, then perhaps one can do it in a good way in clinical chemistry routine. The T criterion, if one with T means tau tangle pathology, it's almost only tau PET that fulfills that criterion. In the tables that will be published regarding this, phosphatau is put into that category too. But then I think it's important to remember that phosphatau is likely a predictive marker of tangle pathology rather than a direct marker of tangle pathology. And this can have relevance in settings where you, for example, look at the prevalence of different stages of Alzheimer's disease. Because if you use tau PET as the T marker, then you will have fewer people who are A plus T plus. You will have more who are A plus T negative. But if you then put in phosphatau instead in CSF or plasma, then you will get more people who are concordantly positive for A beta and tau. Since then, biomarkers you are measuring are closer to each other because there is a direct effect of amyloid on both direct amyloid tests and phosphorylated tau.
In the tau PET, I mean, obviously, there's an access issue, I think, everywhere, even in the U.S. And the clinical label for them, we're taking something that's continuous and we're making binary, elevated, non-elevated, even though there's a whole space between. And one of the things that I think so far the tau PET ligand has shown is it's much better at finding Braak stages 5-6. For example, there's a little bit of murkiness when individuals are more like the 3-4 stage.
Exactly. All this can be highly relevant if we end up in a situation where we would like to treat people at the stage of Alzheimer's disease when the tau pathology is not as advanced. We will see both in the trials now and also perhaps in clinical practice if we will find out that if there is high tau PET ligand retention in the brain and if it's widespread, perhaps then the disease has progressed a little bit too far for the patient to be able to respond well to an anti-amyloid treatment. There is also a possibility of using the fluid-based biomarkers in this context, although more research needs to be done here, because it looks like some of the phosphatau markers in CSF and plasma have a relationship to Braak stage. So phosphatau 217 increases in response to amyloid, but then you see a stepwise further increase the more advanced the patient is. If you have the availability of tau PET data and can tau PET Braak stage your patient. Now there are some attempts to see if one could actually standardize this so that one could predict the Braak stage from a plasma phosphatau 217 concentration. There is also a possibility of combining phosphatau 231, which is the earliest form, with 217, and perhaps another phosphatau form, which is called 205, which is later, and thereby get some kind of staging system. But I wouldn't dare to do that now, not in clinical practice, but we should do it in research settings and then eventually see if we could nail down stable assays with which we could do this. I think there is potential here, that more research is needed. And then this could be done, of course, in settings where it's hard to get access to tau PET. So staging by fluid-based biomarkers is starting to happen, but it's still early days. And I would say at the moment, I wouldn't dare to stage a patient in a clinical setting, but you can do it with tau PET relatively well. There is another use of tau PET where the fluid biomarkers will not suffice, and that is when you have atypical presentations. If you want to determine where in the brain is the tau pathology, could this explain why a patient has a certain symptomatology which is atypical? That's a super exciting top area where I'm not an expert at all, but this is where I've heard from neurologists.
Non-amnestic presentations of AD where, for example, language predominance or visuospatial predominance or even behavioral executive versions where tau pathology may be more concentrated in hubs that are thought to be involved with those processes.
Exactly.
The other thing about tau PET that's interesting is that what we see in trials, right, there's the ability to quantify and get renderings, et cetera, whereas in clinic, that's not so available yet. Again, the readers, according to the label, have to read it as elevated, non-elevated.
Exactly.
Let me pivot to something you said about when tangles are very elevated, this may decrease the effect size and benefit of amyloid plaque-lowering drugs. I've been working in this field for 18 years with the early drugs, including bapineuzumab. And one of the things we didn't know, we didn't have the biomarkers. So about 20% of individuals that used to come into our trials did not have elevated amyloid. So they probably had CD43, a Lewy body, something else. And here that we were giving them amyloid-lowering drugs, and 20% of them were washed. They didn't have the disease as we could measure it. And then we were doing it in the later stages. We were looking at mild and moderate dementia stages. And then we're also giving it at lower doses. So we actually had really no proof of target engagement. And over time, these are some of the things that really have helped us develop these new class of drugs, going earlier, clinically going with higher doses, showing target engagement, actually lowering amyloid plaques. When you had mentioned going earlier, if you had to summarize what is coming out of the most current data between lecanemab and donanemab, can you summarize what's being seen there? Because they had different designs, but it seems like whether it was primary design, as in the case of the donanemab trials, Trailblazer 2, or the data coming from Clarity, it does seem like individuals who were earlier clinically and maybe tangle-wise probably had higher effect sizes as a group.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, I've just followed the presentations that have been made publicly on this, but I think everyone would agree that it looks really promising to go early. And the lecanemab data that were presented some months ago, where this subgroup analysis was done, that tau PET was relatively normal and the patients thereby were in a very early stage, then it looked like one could almost stop the deterioration over time in those patients.
Much larger.
Exactly. Yeah. And also the donanemab design per se also made sure that there were not too advanced tau pathology in the group. So I think there is great hope for going earlier and that we might see even better effects than we have seen in the current phase 3 clinical trials. And it makes sense, I think. And hopefully we will see a little bit of less side effects also if also the amyloid pathology is a little bit less widespread. I'm thinking about amyloid-related imaging abnormalities. Yes. Exactly. Those have really indicated that we need better biomarkers for the cerebrovasculature, of course. I mean, small vessel disease is important by itself for brain aging, but ARIA has made the research into cerebrovascular markers intensify. It could well be that people who have amyloid pathology and small vessel disease are more vulnerable to this side effect, or it's just a matter of how much amyloid you have in the vessel walls, since amyloid plaque pathology often go with amyloid angiopathy as well. But it's still not known if that is the explanation for ARIA, or if it's simply that you have small vessel disease and vessels that are a little bit brittle and vulnerable.
Right. I want to come back to ARIA, but kind of going back to efficacy, I think there's data now, much of it published and presented, that it looks at, for example, putting all these different amyloid lowering studies onto axes. So you have clinical benefit on one side and plaque lowering, And you see a relationship across trials and programs with the degree of amyloid lowering. The more lowering, there seems to be more clinical effect, whether that's a global clinical staging, clinical dementia rating, CDR, or a cognitive scale, or a daily function scale. And our first fully approved aducanumab received accelerated approval based on the biomarker effect of lowering plaques with a reasonable likelihood of clinical benefit. And now aducanumab's clinical development has been stopped. But lecanemab was the first one after the Clarity AD data that was fully approved traditionally. And then, of course, we've seen the donanemab data, and that's pending. I guess to me, where I'm summarizing is, for groups, these were all individuals who had to be in the right stage. So they had to be in the early symptomatic stage, MCI, or mild dementia with Alzheimer's. They had to have biomarker confirmation, right? And they had to have other factors, sort of some of them, depending on the study, whether it was an MMSE criteria or some other kind of test. But the other part that you mentioned that goes on with the ARIA is that they all had baseline MRIs and individuals who had microhemorrhages, cerebral amyloid angiopathy. So if they had lobar or cortical subcortical microhemorrhages, if there was five or more, they didn't come into the study.
Exactly.
But the consistency between the results are interesting for the whole population. It seemed like, yeah, over 18 months, a substantial portion of individuals can be made from amyloid positive to amyloid negative. Not everybody, right? So the end of the trials, actually, whether it was a quarter to a third or 20% in the various trials, actually still had not come down to the amyloid negative portion. But along with that, across outcome measures, there seemed to be somewhere between a 25 to 35, even in some cases, maybe 40% slowing of clinical decline. And that was the average response. And then, as you were saying, whether it was the lecanemab study results that were secondary analysis presented at CTAD 2023, or some of the donanemab data suggests that in groups where the tangle pathology was not as advanced, there may be even a larger effect size. So using these biomarkers in some sense to predict potential for having a higher magnitude of benefit. And of course, on the other side, there's the burden and the safety we want to talk about.
Exactly. I think this really calls for biomarker-based staging of Alzheimer's pathology, and perhaps that way we find the sweet spot for initiation of treatment. And then we also need to develop better biomarkers for alpha-synuclein and TDP-43. Now, with alpha-synuclein, there is actually a really nice test. It requires CSF at the moment, but you can potentially also do it in other biofluids. It gives you a bimodal readout, positive, negative, for alpha-synuclein pathology. And both Sterling Johnson in Wisconsin and Oscar Hansson in Lund have shown that if you have MCI with amyloid and a positive CSF alpha-synuclein test, the test is called RT-QuIC, then you have a very much more rapid disease progression. And using this in on samples collected in clinical trials to check if that could determine if you're a responder or not would be very interesting. And I hope that will be possible to do also for TDP-43 in the future. TDP-43, that pathology is so common, and really it's a common cove pathology that we would like to be able to detect using biomarkers. There are some interesting blood extracellular vesicle data on this now that could potentially give us the biomarker that we are looking for, but it's still early days.
So because of these common co-pathologies, as you mentioned, if you're in your 80s probably and have Alzheimer's pathology, there's some data from autopsy data that 40 to 50% also have a TDP-43. A co-pathology, and we also know a substantial number of, well, certainly if you have Lewy body disease, a substantial, maybe three quarters also have Alzheimer's pathology. But the other way around, if you have Alzheimer's disease, there's also some, maybe it's 5, 10, 15%, we'll find out, have a Lewy body pathology. And so you may need a panel of biomarkers, both predictive of progression and course, and potentially for response of how much of this is now amyloid dependent versus independent, and in what stages. So that's very exciting. Going back to ARIA, so being described first not quite 20 years ago in the bapineuzumab trials of being two variants, you know, we have the effusion edema variant and we have the hemorrhagic variants, which is, you know, microhemorrhages, superficial siderosis, and rarely macrohemorrhages. And these are now seen across programs and across drugs that are amyloid lowering. And as you mentioned, we really don't understand quite the pathophysiology, although there's animal models and other things that suggest that with 20 years of amyloid deposition, some of that is deposited in the media of the blood vessels. And with amyloid lowering drugs, there can be antibody mediated both inflammation inside the blood vessels. Some of it can actually be removed to be friable. And there can also be sort of this log jam in the vasculature, in the perivascular space that may be causing ARIA. But it's something that's seen and in clinical trials, we've dealt with it and we know how to manage it. But it's something in real life that still requires resources and discussions with patients and families.
Is your experience also that this is really something which is most prevalent during the first half year of treatment and it's not as common?
Right. The risk factors that we've identified so far are APOE4. If you're E4 homozygous, that's the highest risk for developing any kind of ARIA, developing recurrent ARIA also. And the other risk is the amount of probably cerebrovascular CAA type of pathology that you have, right? So the number of microhemorrhages and white matter disease probably are correlates and markers of how much cerebral amyloid angiopathy there is. So those are the main two risks. Of course, drug dose, the time post, early versus later. And there's one emerging thing, as you saw in CTAD, that maybe a higher blood pressure also could be potentially a risk. But you're right. In the clinical trials, the vast majority of ARIA occurred in the early periods. And there was surveillance usually at the time, and there were algorithms of depending on the radiographic severity versus the clinical severity, what to do with it. But it turns out that some ARIA can be late and some ARIA can be recurrent. So it's something that we still have to learn in clinical practice and need better biomarkers.
Exactly. Some ARIA biomarkers would be really nice. We need to find those.
Right. Right. Kind of looking ahead, I know in the US we have full approval. I'll disclose I'm part of the appropriate use group, that ADRD Therapeutics Work Group, and we have appropriate use recommendations for these drugs that go along with the prescription information. But how do you see the ideal patients and approaches to selection and counseling of patients for these drugs?
Yes, it will require, of course, an assessment so that you have some type of early symptomatic stage of Alzheimer's disease, and then you have to prove the or make it likely that there is amyloid pathology. And then one could, of course, state that, okay, it's good to do amyloid PET as a start, but that's not available everywhere. And now the concordance of the plasma phosphorylated tau tests with amyloid PET really make it look like we could help select patients who are very likely to have amyloid pathology as an explanation for the cognitive symptoms they might have sought help for by a plasma phosphorylated tau test. And it looks like for most tests, the best performance could be gained if we didn't just focus on a reference limit, but perhaps two cut points, one above which you are almost 100% certain to be amyloid PET positive, and one below which you're almost 100% certain to be amyloid PET negative. And then you have a gray zone. And that gray zone, depending on assay, that gray zone is between 15 and 25% of the patients who you might then, if the patient ends up with a blood biomarker result in that gray zone, and you think it might be Alzheimer's, then you could do a CSF or an amyloid PET. So that is a clinical scenario through which we could facilitate identifying the patients who might be likely to respond. Then one could also potentially think about some type of simplified testing. But now we talk about the future here, where you could combine a plasma measure with, for example, a digital assessment tool, and thereby actually get a good sense already before the patient is referred to a specialist, that the specialist could evaluate these types of measures. And perhaps if we think in Europe, at least in Sweden, it's very likely that these patients first will appear in the primary care. And then perhaps this blood test with some type of cognitive assessment, potentially with a digital assessment tool, could be something that the memory clinic specialist could look at before accepting a patient for evaluation, or if you're negative and there is a strong indication of a neurodegenerative disease, that you could detect it, for example, neurofilament light in a blood test also, then you could get evaluation for non-Alzheimer's neurodegenerative diseases, which is also super important, of course. But this is the easiest way, I think, to which we can more easily find patients who might benefit from the anti-amyloid treatments.
I see. So yeah. Then, like you said, if you have they fall in the definitively negative range, you're looking for a different cause.
Exactly.
Or contributor, major contributor to a driver of their cognitive impairment. You're not right. going to stop clinically. And then if it's absolutely positive, then potentially in the future, this may be something where you may be able to forego, possibly, in the right clinical setting, the more expensive and less accessible tests like the amyloid PET scans. And there may be that 15 to 25%, depending on, again, the population and et cetera, where going forward to additional testing may be important.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And if we think about the readiness of clinical laboratories to do this, already now you have a couple of labs that can do plasma beta tests and plasma phosphatide tests in the US. And we see more and more laboratories in Europe also being able to do it. And if we think about Asia and other parts of the world, South America, we see that there are laboratories now coming up that can do these types of measurements. The assays, there are several assays now, for example, for phosphatidylserine that perform really well. We have just completed an assay comparison study supported by an Alzheimer's Association grant where we see real nice performance of most of the plasma phosphatidylserine tests. So I am actually very optimistic that we will be able to do this in clinical chemistry practice we hope to be up and running in Gothenburg here this year, and several labs are on the way to do this. So even though people say that we have a lot of additional research to do, I feel that we don't have to discover biomarkers from scratch. We know we have assays that look really good and that have been well validated.
Yes, so the process is really a bit more validation across clinical populations and clinical
exactly.
settings, and a little bit more in sort of labs that are not specialty labs.
Exactly. The nice thing now is several of the assays are up and running on these fully automated clinical chemistry workhorses, those instruments that are basically random access instruments where a technician can put in a tube and then the instrument does everything. So this will work outside specialty laboratories, which makes me really hopeful that this will be a relatively smooth process. I often say that I'm for relatively early clinical adoption of these tests because and I don't mean sounding sloppy or reckless here, because I think we learn when we start to use things in clinical practice, then we learn enormously together with clinical colleagues. Also, when we compare laboratory results between laboratories and also together with the patients, as long as we don't overinterpret the biomarker results, and as long as we never interpret the biomarker result outside a clinical context, then I think we can do this. And then one would use the blood biomarker result as one additional tool in the complete assessment of the patient. So sometimes there are headlines in the news that there is now a diagnostic test for Alzheimer's disease in blood, but I don't like that at all, because it's the clinician making the diagnosis with a lot of other variables. And I would be perfectly fine with a clinician getting a phosphatide result that is abnormal, and still the clinician says that there are so many other things that speak against Alzheimer's in this particular case. Yeah. So I don't think it is that. It's very rare in clinical chemistry with complete black and white results that are completely diagnostic. It's very rare. Yeah. So I think we should think about these new blood tests in the same way as we think about troponins, liver enzymes, hemoglobin, all these types of clinical chemistry tests that we use together with a lot of other information and eventually come to a conclusion on the most likely diagnosis. And then if you do something, if you initiate a treatment and you feel that it's not really helping or so, then you have to reevaluate the diagnosis and perhaps reconsider the whole thing. And eventually, since we are in this wonderful situation that we have amyloid PET and CSF, perhaps one will have a look in those compartments instead for a certain patient where the whole thing doesn't really fit completely. So we are in a good place with Alzheimer's disease diagnostics, having both simpler assays that are affordable and more advanced assays for select patients where we are not certain.
Yeah, I really like the way you put that, Henrik, as far as that this is, has to be part of a overall evaluation process,
yeah,
which has to be patient-centered with the goals, requires clinical assessment and counseling. And you put it in as a clinician as part of that,
yeah,
but it's not a something black and white litmus test that one can give, and that wouldn't be best care. I think we've covered a lot today, and I think the enthusiasm is real. There's a rational basis for being able to use these biomarkers, and as they're emerging in real ways with patients and families, certainly they're informing our clinical trials, and we're going to learn more over time. And now we have drugs that are becoming available that can at least mitigate and lower one component of the pathobiology, and we have to learn how to optimize those with respect to patient selection and efficacy and safety. So very exciting times. We could be at this for hours and hours, but I really appreciate all the insight. I always learn something from you, and I love the way you explain things. So
it's the same with me. I've learned a lot here. And I should just mention one small thing, and that is in response to the anti-amyloid treatments, we now see that plasma phospho-tau is reduced. So there is this type of nice effect of the anti-amyloid treatments on the downstream marker of an amyloid effect on neurons. But the reduction is 30 to 40%. So it's not so far a complete normalization. And this we have to look, here we have to keep our eyes open and try to understand why if amyloid PET becomes negative, but phospho-tau doesn't become completely negative, what does that mean? Is there still some amyloid around? Or is this reflecting some type of amyloid-triggered but amyloid-independent tau pathophysiology? We don't know that, but we will learn with time, I'm sure.
But it sounds like, again, we can use it for a biomarker of state.
Exactly.
Of positivity, a potentially predictive biomarker of even staging tau pathology, maybe, again, with more work to do, and maybe treatment response eventually. So, again, lots of possibilities for these biomarkers.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you and, of course, the audience who's participating in this. And this is an activity that has a lot of resources online. The resources can be found online at CME Outfitters Alzheimer's Disease Hub for healthcare providers and patients. And for those of you participating to receive credit for the program, please complete the post-test and evaluation online. And I hope that you found this as exciting as I do and that we do more of these programs and learn from Dr. Zetterberg. Thank you, Hendrik. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.